Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second episode of Murder Monday on Late Night Crime Cast. I just want to remind you guys that I plan on doing Murder Mondays once a month on a random Monday. You'll probably know that I'm going to post a Murder Monday because I will not be posting the Wednesday before, which, as you can see, I did not post this last Wednesday. Instead, you'll get two episodes in the upcoming week, which means basically lucky you. I'm going to be posting today and Wednesday. This is my last time I'm going to be introducing this idea. I just thought I'd include it again today for those who were wondering why I didn't post last Wednesday. But anyway, I'm your host, Robin Steffens. You may or may not know me from my YouTube channel, in which I have a crime series based around kidnappings, murders, and the criminals themselves. This show will be very similar to that. So if you're like me and you love true crime, especially if you get tangled in those cases that just keep you up late at night, you're gonna love Murder Mondays. Today, we are gonna be discussing the Gainesville Ripper. And just wow, this is really close to home. I have friends that went to UF and that lived in Gainesville. Friends that, I mean, I visited in Gainesville. And so, I just feel like even though this was a completely different time, before we were even born, before, you know, our whole existence, it's just something that I never knew prior to doing research on this, so I just find it so interesting that it happened in that area that I'm pretty familiar with. So let's get into it. The Gainesville Ripper, also known as Danny Harold Rolling. Danny Harold Rolling was born on May 1954 to his parents Claudia and James Rolling. At the time, the family was living in Shreveport, Louisiana. His father was actually a cop there, and he often abused his mother. So his parents, they had gotten married when his mother was just 19 years old, so, you know, pretty young, and just 2 weeks after the marriage, she found out she was pregnant. And this really angered his father. He never wanted children, and so he ended up taking this out on his growing family. Before Danny was even born, his father was beating his mother while she was pregnant. And then he was born, and his father started to abuse him before he could even walk. When he was as young as 1 year old, his father would beat him for things like not crawling properly. And this is actually really ironic to me because if you guys don't know, I used to work as a child protective investigator. And one of the signs we looked for was underdevelopment in the child when investigating abuse cases. This is because children that are abused, they develop slower than children that are well cared for and loved. So I just found it to be a bit ironic that so early on his father started abusing him for things like this when his abuse was probably the main catalyst. So yeah, he was abused and as I mentioned, actually in the last Murder Monday, being abused at a young age is a pretty common denominator in serial killers and violent offenders in general. So keep that in mind. He was abused before he could even walk. Then the next year, in 1955, when his brother was born, the abuse only got worse for him. And of course the mother, she was being abused herself, and she knew that her small child was being abused. And she would try to leave, she'd pack up with just herself and the kids, but she would always return. So it was like this back and forth thing. His mother had admitted later in court that, you know, when he was being charged for his crimes, that Danny was suffering physical abuse at least once or twice a week at the hands of his father. I mean, growing up, the children in that household, they were not allowed to have birthdays, they were not allowed to celebrate holidays, and his father, he would beat them so badly, he would tie them up, cuff him and his brother together, leave them outside, suffocate them by kneeling on their necks. I mean, he would even use his position as a police officer to get Danny thrown into jail. So of course, he was continuously abused throughout all of his childhood, and he had a mother who just couldn't and maybe wouldn't defend him because, you know, she was scared of being abused herself. And of course, this impacted him greatly. I want to rewind a bit, In the third grade, he actually ended up failing, and his school counselors described him as suffering from an inferiority complex with aggressive tendencies and poor impulse control, which is kind of foreshadowing like his future, honestly. And so after he failed, this whole incident, it caused his mother to have a mental breakdown. And I mean, clearly him failing and his counselor saying these things about him, this was a result of his abuse, but I'm sure at the time they didn't know. It was actually recommended that he receive more counseling, but he just never did. And so this all just kept on going on pretty much unchecked. Now, later down the line, around age 11, Danny started picking up, you know, music and using his musical talents to cope with his abusive father and basically his messed up childhood. He would play guitar and sing songs. He would sing hymns, you know, things like that. And this was something that was only able to keep him happy for a short time period, because around the same time, his mother ended up slitting her wrist and getting committed to a hospital. And after this big incident, after his mother, you know, doing this, he began to do drugs and drink alcohol. So here you can imagine, his home life is already terrible. He's struggling to cope with it. He has to turn to drugs and alcohol, which, in my opinion, just further deteriorated his mental state. I mean, he was being abused. He was going through so much. And things just, they didn't get better from there. You know, it seemed like he was going in the right direction. Things were going okay for him. And then he decided to enlist in the Air Force. He ended up working as a security police and Strategic Air Command at Homestead AFB, Florida. But it was only for a short period of time because his habits started to catch up to him. He was sent out of the Air Force after too much drug use, some of which included taking acid more than 100 times. He was locked up for drug possession charges and for disobeying orders. During this time, he was diagnosed by a psychiatrist as having a personality disorder, and he was forced to leave the Air Force under dishonorable discharge. After his discharge, he returned to Shreveport to live with his grandfather. He started going to church and he found religion at a Pentecostal church. And so he gets baptized and he becomes very involved in church activities. At this point, he's starting to get clean. Things are starting to really look up, and he even meets his wife around this time, Omatha Ann Halco. It's around 1973 and he's 19 years old. They marry in 1974 and they go on to begin what appears to be a normal life. The next year, in 1975, they end up welcoming a daughter, Kylie Danielle. But of course, you can imagine what begins to happen in that relationship. He begins drinking and doing drugs again, and he leaves church and starts acting so irrational that his wife becomes afraid of him. He begins to become violent towards his wife, threatening to do her harm, and it gets so bad that at age 23, after being together for 4 years, his wife decides to leave him. And soon after she leaves him, she files for divorce, and they are officially divorced 6 months later. Of course, Danny is devastated by this, and he turns his devastations over his failed marriage into anger. That same year, he ends up raping a woman who closely resembles his ex-wife. And then later that year, he kills a woman in a car accident. This really seems like a turning point for him, and he's really tormented over it. He starts to become suicidal, and he attempts to kill himself, but he's not able to go through with it. So instead, he turns to crime. And you guys can kind of see the cycle where he goes through these episodes where he just decides to turn to crime and just becomes increasingly violent. Like, sometimes it seems like he's doing okay, and then he just goes just completely violent, turns to crime. And I see this cycle, like, in his story. I keep on seeing it, and so I just thought I'd point that out. So, in 1979, he goes on a crime spree, and he commits armed robberies in Alabama, Georgia, and Louisiana. He's eventually caught, and he's sentenced to 2 concurrent 6-year terms in prison. Then, in 1984, he's released from prison and he returns to Shreveport to see his mother and father. He stays there for a short time until he and his father get into a fight, and then he ends up staying with his aunt, and then, of course, he eventually returns to his parents. So, at this point, he's just kind of going around, you know, biding his time, struggling to get jobs because of his criminal past, his criminal history, and so it's about just a year later that he's back to committing crimes again. On 7/22/1985, he robs a Kroger, and then the next day he steals his family car. He is, of course, caught soon after, and he ends up getting sentenced to 4 years in prison on 3/20/1986. Then, a little over 2 years later, on 7/19/1988, he is let out on parole. He starts living in Shreveport again and gets a job, but he's fired from it on 11/4/1989. And this is where it gets interesting, because there's a reason that he's fired from his job. He's fired because he ends up missing that day of work. And it just so happens that on 11/6/1989, three bodies are found. This is just 2 days after he's fired. A 24-year-old woman named Julie Grissom is found raped and murdered. Her father, Tom, and his 8-year-old grandson, Sean, are also killed. All of them are stabbed to death. As for Julie, her body is found with her legs spread and her hair carefully fanned onto her bed. She is discovered with tape marks on her wrist and bite marks on her breast. She was one of Danny's first kills. And he arranged her corpse, and the way he arranged her corpse was something that would become a signature for him. So he had seemingly got away with these murders, and he went on normally. But soon he kind of broke again. You know, like I said, he goes through these periods of time where it's just nothing, and then it's just violence. So on 5/18 of 1990, he got into a fight with his father and ended up shooting him, one time in the stomach and once in the forehead. His father actually ended up surviving this, but he ended up losing an eye and an ear. So after this incident, he pretty much runs away. He breaks into a man's house and steals papers with identification on it for a Michael Kennedy. He also steals two guns and, you know, over a few weeks period, he steals money from two stores, you know, commits robbery, and gets away with almost $4,000 worth. After that, he changes his identity with the papers he stole, and then he uses the money to take a bus to Sarasota, Florida, and start a new life as Michael Kennedy Jr. This was in late July of 1990. From there, he keeps up with his crime spree. In August of 1990, he steals a car and drives to Tampa, Florida. He ends up committing numerous burglaries before he returns to Gainesville. And so, remember how I said before that he ends up kind of like, you know, chilling for a little bit and then getting violent? It just doesn't seem that he is doing that anymore at this point. It just seems like it's just violence, 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 violence. It was on 8/24/1990, after he returned to Gainesville, that he broke into a house of two college freshmen. He was armed with an automatic pistol and a knife. This was the house of Sonja Larson and Christina Powell. He first discovered Powell asleep on the downstairs couch. He did not wake her up and instead went to explore the upstairs bedroom where Larson was asleep. Larson ends up waking up and Danny attacks her, and he ends up taping her mouth shut to stifle her screams and then stabs her to death. He then goes back downstairs, tapes Powell's mouth shut, bounds her wrists together behind her back, and threatens her with a knife as he cuts off her clothes. He then rapes her and forces her face down onto the floor, where he stabs her 5 times in the back. He returns to Sonja's body and rapes her as well. He then poses the bodies in sexually provocative positions, and then he takes a shower before leaving the apartment. He then leaves the apartment and throws all evidence he had in a dumpster. And I just want to mention that he really mutilated these girls. Like, he cut off their nipples and everything. It's just really horrific how these crime scenes are described and the gore involved. But it doesn't stop there. On 8/25/1990, he finds his next victim. Another student, Krista Hoyt. He rapes and murders her in a similar fashion. And the murder is even more grisly. He cuts off her head and puts her beheaded body on the edge of her bed sitting upright. Her nipples are also cut off and lay beside her. Her head is put on a shelf across the room. So with all of these gruesome, grisly murders happening, the campus starts to explode with the talk of the murders. These murders all occurred less than 2 miles from each other, and they're all around the University of Florida, so everyone's on high alert. The university cancels classes for a week, and students are bringing baseball bats with them everywhere they go. No one's going out alone, whether it's night or day. Students triple lock their doors, they sleep in shifts, and by the end of August, thousands of students are leaving campus and some to never return as they feared for their lives. Despite all the precautions being taken, Danny is still able to kill once more. On 8/27/1990, he breaks into the apartment of Tracy Pauls and Manuel Tabata. He kills both of them. Pauls is left posed, but Tabata is not. There are no mutilations to these bodies, even though it is thought that maybe he was possibly interrupted before he could. It's then the next month in the beginning of September 1990. He begins a robbery spree again. And like I said, he's kind of stopped going from, like, you know, his up and down where he commits a crime, a very violent crime. And then he just, like, stops. It's just crime after crime after crime at this point. So he begins a robbery spree again. He's stealing from businesses, breaking into homes, and is soon discovered in Ocala. From there, he leads police on a high-speed chase. But on 9/8/1990, they are able to arrest him. And without knowing his involvement in the murders, they're actually able to find evidence that implicates him. So by 9/12/1990, there is this huge story that's making the front page of every single news cover. And it's the news story of the Gainesville Ripper. Now, by November of 1991, his DNA is matched to the Gainesville murders and the murders in Shreveport, Louisiana. They were actually able to make the connections due to the similarities of the cases and the posing of the bodies that he did. So, like I said before, this posing kind of became his signature. And so this really is what got him caught and what tied the murders together. So he was already in prison for numerous crimes that he had committed, but he then had an impending trial to face for the actual murders. On February 1994, he is convicted of 5 murder charges and is sentenced to 5 death sentences. He tries to appeal it, but of course it's denied. I mean, he's pretty much caught and he actually made a confession to the police, so there's really nothing he can do. I mean, there's no way they're gonna give him an appeal. So then it's just left for him to wait for his execution, and on 10/25/2006, he's officially executed. He was executed by lethal injection and was singing as he died. Strangely enough, this murderer inspired films like Scream, and I mean, there were many TV shows and books written about it. It's really crazy how he had such an impact and influence, and it's really actually a negative influence, of course, but it's just crazy how his murder spree got that big. And clearly, I think because it was on a college campus and there's just so much fear around young people, you know, and murder, things like that. That's literally every single horror movie ever, like young people, you know, all together being murdered by a mysterious person that just seems to not be able to get caught. So I get that, but I just found it really interesting that this inspired something like Scream, like as big of a franchise as that. I really think the way he did his murders, it was gruesome, it was disgusting, and he actually had said that he wanted to just kind of get that same level of fame that Ted Bundy did, which is so sick and such a horrible way to think in life. I honestly believe he was a horrible person. Yes, he had his horrible upbringing and he was abused, but I don't think abuse or anything like that is ever an excuse for someone to commit such horrific crimes. But yeah, I think we're gonna end this Murder Monday here. This was really a hard research because just of how gruesome the crimes were and how disgusting. It's just gross to me. Like, he mutilated these people. He was an evil, evil man. So that's really all I have to say about this Murder Monday. I hope you guys found it interesting, and I hope you guys listen in on Wednesday for our regular podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening, and tune in again on Wednesday.